Sometimes young children will get into conversations with their friends about whose dad is better. My dad's bigger than your dad. Oh yeah, my dad's stronger than your dad. Or my dad's smarter than your dad. It goes back and forth. It's very important for everyone to know that the person's dad was better, right? I know of one young person whose response is, well, my dad can eat faster than your dad. So it's whatever it takes. It wasn't one of our kids, by the way. There are all sorts of reasons why we're proud of our dads. But there's a story in the Old Testament about a father who did something his sons were not very proud of. Let's turn over to Numbers chapter 16. Numbers chapter 16. In verse 1, a very familiar story. It says in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 1, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. So we're going to read the story of Korah and his rebellion. First of all, it's interesting to note that Korah and Moses were cousins. It's easy to miss that unless we look at the names, but we read, and you can just put this in your notes, in Exodus 6 and verse 16, it says, the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Kohath were Amram and Izhar. In verse 20 of Exodus 6, it says, Amram was the father of Moses. And as we just read here, verse 21, Izhar was the father of Korah. So Moses' father and Korah's father were brothers. So Moses and Korah were cousins. Now that might even help to explain a little bit of what was happening in the story. You know, sometimes family relations can bring closeness and strong connections. Sometimes they can do the opposite. Sometimes it can turn into rivalry and jealousy. And maybe there was a little bit of that with Korah towards Moses. Back to Numbers 16 and verse 2. It says, they took men and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy. Every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? And yes, God intended for the whole congregation to be holy. In fact, it's exactly what he said through Moses in Exodus 19:6. Again, you can just jot it in your notes if you want to read it later. I'll just read it, the text, because we're going to keep going in Numbers. But Exodus 19, verse 6, it says, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But then God goes right on saying that now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be a special treasure to me. So nowhere did God intend for what Korah was doing to be the result of explaining that they were to be a holy nation. But certainly that's the hammer he was using to try to bash Moses with. And even being a kingdom of priests, that was something prophetic that would come way down the line. We think of in the millennium being kings and priests reigning and ruling with Christ in the kingdom. That's the destiny of the saints. But this was a horrible action that Korah and his friends were taking. So let's go back to number 16 and verse 4. So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. You know, he recognized that this was a potential disaster that was coming upon the nation. And he recognized that this was an incredibly dangerous situation, that he was worried that God would strike them down right there, and he fell on his face in humility before God, complete submission before God, because he knew what was coming. Verse 5, and he said to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. Moses was saying, yes, Korah, the whole congregation is holy. Of course, that's what God told us, but it's not because of your greatness, it's because of God's presence. And because of him working through those who have the right spirit and obey him, they can be a part of that holy nation, but not those who are carnal and self-centered. Verse 6, so he says, do this, take censers, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them and put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the Holy One. You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. You know, he said, to have the audacity to presume to take on the role of leading in worship by greed and by force. He said, you clearly don't understand God, the one who you claim to be serving. So verse 8, then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to serve them? And that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi with you, and are you seeking the priesthood also? Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord, and what is Aaron that you complain against him? So you get the picture. These were Levites, the men with Korah, some of them, some were Reubenites, but others were Levites that were already serving in the tabernacle. They already had roles in the service to the congregation and service to God, but it wasn't enough for them to have physical roles. They wanted to be in charge. They wanted to be running the show. They wanted the priesthood also, and they didn't get it. So chapter 16 and verse 12. So Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, we will not come up. So remember, now we're talking about two sons of Reuben. So a different family, but perhaps even the same spirit of jealousy, because Reuben had not been given the leadership of the nation because of his own sins. Another similar story. They said, we will not come up. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of the land, out of a land flowing with milk and honey, to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us? You can see their attitude. Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. So you get this picture. They didn't respond to the correction from Moses, and even responded with sarcasm and disrespect. They wouldn't even come to the tabernacle to have a meeting with Moses, really behaving like children, like little children, and it was escalating and getting worse. Verse 15. Notice, then Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them. And Moses said to Korah, verse 16, tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Lord, you and they as well as Aaron. Let each take his censer and put incense in it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 censers, both you and Aaron, each with his censer. So every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense in it, on it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and with Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. Now again, put yourselves in the shoes of Moses and Aaron. I don't know how many we have here today, but usually we might have 200 or 250 people. So similar crowd to Moses and Aaron standing before these men, 250 of the congregation. I don't think he was afraid. Moses was afraid in that sense, but you could tell it shook him. And he recognized how dangerous of a situation this is for the whole nation. In fact, later on in the story, we know that many of the other Israelites died in a plague after God took care of the rebels. Just as God was getting the nation off the ground, so to speak, this was a really critical time. So this group of 250 leaders, the real movers and shakers in the whole nation, they were coming up against Moses and Aaron. Notice in verse 20. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation that I may consume them in a moment. I think this was what Moses had been expecting. And again, they fell on their faces, verse 22. And said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation? In verse 23, so the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. So they got away from around the tents of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives, their sons, and their little children. Now we're spending a bit of time in this story, because, brethren, I want to get a sense of what was happening. And you know what's coming next. Verse 28, and Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord. Now it came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korah, and with all their goods. So they and all those with them went down alive into the pit. The earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. Just an absolutely devastating event, you can imagine, for those who witnessed this, and certainly just incredibly tragic that cycle of events that started with Korah and his friends. Then all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. So this is the story of Korah, the cousin of Moses. and the arrogance and the audacity of these men and how they were destroyed. Now, we read that the families of Dathan and Abiram were destroyed as well. But there's a detail that we can miss, maybe. Or looking at it the other way, assume something that isn't there. And that is, was the family of Korah destroyed? What happened to the family of Korah? It says the Dathan and Abiram and their families perished. But what happened to the family of Korah, brethren? Was his family destroyed? First of all, let's turn very quickly over to Exodus chapter 6 and verse 24. Exodus chapter 6 and verse 24, the three of the sons, or three sons of Korah, are actually named here. Exodus 6 and verse 24, it says, "And the sons of Korah were Asir, Elkanah, and Abiasaph. These are the families of the Korahites." Interesting. It even mentions that they had families and they were called the Korahites. That's rather intriguing, if you think about it. Notice another passage that is even more clear, Numbers chapter 26. Numbers chapter 26 and verse 9. Numbers 26 and verse 9, it says, "The sons of Eliab were Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram." These are the Dathan and Abiram representatives of the congregation who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah. When they contended against the Lord, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men and they became a sign. Nevertheless, verse 11, the children of Korah did not die. Have you ever noticed that? I came across this recently, and it was sort of intriguing. You sort of assume that their families, his families, died, but they didn't. The children of Korah did not die. So let's think this through a little bit. When Moses commanded the children of Israel to get away from these evil men, what did the sons of Korah do? I think we can assume that they were already grown. They were not small children anymore. Otherwise, they probably would have been with their parents. But one way or the other, they walked away from him, didn't they? They walked away from Korah. Now, we don't have a whole lot of detail of how this happened, but they did not die in the rebellion of Korah. So think about the family dynamics at one point or another. What were those dynamics? Maybe the sons of Korah saw through what he was doing well before this. I think we can assume that there was a lot of whispering in the tent of Korah. Maybe for days, maybe for weeks, maybe for months. There was a lot of talk. There was a lot of negativity. Well before this, in the private, maybe heated discussions in the tent of Korah. And maybe they tried to talk him out of this. His sons did. You know, no outright rebellion happens overnight. Or maybe the sons of Korah went along with it. But then at some point, maybe at this point, maybe at the time that Moses said, get away from these men, maybe they decided, this is crazy. And we can tell where this is going, and maybe they walked away from their dad. Either way, a very difficult choice for three sons to not side with their father, wouldn't you say? Any of you who have had to go against family, even father or mother, coming into the truth, you know that feeling maybe very well. It's a difficult thing to do. So whatever became of the sons of Korah? Does the story end here? Actually, not. And that's a rather long introduction for a sermon. I'll give you the title at this point. It is The Surprising Legacy of the Sons of Korah. The Surprising Legacy of the Sons of Korah. Because actually they have an incredible legacy. They have quite an incredible reputation that they upheld later on. Let's turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 9. Let's skip ahead generations later. Actually, several hundred years later, 1 Chronicles chapter 9 and verse 17. We pick up the story, believe it or not, of the sons of Korah. It says, and the gatekeepers were Shallum. This is talking about the Levites, their function in Jerusalem. This is now by the time David was on the scene and how he organized the singers and the workers there in the service of the tabernacle and then later the temple. But it says, verse 17, the gatekeepers were Shallum, Akub, Talmon, Ahiman, and their brethren. Shallum was the chief. Until then, they had been gatekeepers for the camps of the children of Levi at the king's gate on the east. Shallum, the son of Korah, the son of Ebiasaph, the son of Korah, and his brethren were his father, from his father's house. The Korahites were in charge of the work of the service, gatekeepers of the tabernacle. Their fathers had been keepers of the entrance to the camp of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, had been the officer over them in time past. The Lord was with him. A direct reference to the work of Korah's family and descendants who didn't give up their post for generations, nor their part in the work. The work, brethren, that was not good enough for their father Korah. He wanted more, and he led a rebellion. But after that rebellion was over, the sons got back to work, and they did it admirably. And they did it for generations. Just think about that. Dropping down in verse 28. Now some of them were in charge of the serving vessels, for they brought them in and took them out by count. Some of them were appointed over the furnishings and over all the implements of the sanctuary and over the fine flour and the wine and the oil and the incense and the spices. And some of the sons of the priests made the ointment of the spices. Mattatiah of the Levites, the firstborn of Shallum, the Korahite, had the trusted office over the things that were baked in the pans. So whenever there were offerings that required baking bread, Mattatiah, the son of Shallum, of the line of Korah, had that trusted office, it says. A trusted office specifically mentions that he was trustworthy and he was doing his job faithfully. How intriguing. In fact, in a number of the Psalms, and I think probably many of you know where I'm going with this at this point, a number of the Psalms have been written by the sons of Korah. I want to take some time to go through some of them. Notice in Psalm 42, as we know that some of the singers who were assigned by David, that was a part of the work of the tabernacle and eventually the temple. And in the introduction to some of the Psalms, we find the authors were the sons of Korah. Notice in Psalm 42, verse 1. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before my God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they continually say to me, where is your God? If you look in the introduction, it says, to the chief musician, a contemplation of the sons of Korah. Interesting. Notice in verse 8, It says, the Lord will command. Psalm 42, verse 8, the Lord will command his loving kindness in the daytime and in the night. His song shall be with me, a prayer to the God of my life. A very touching psalm, a very intimate song, psalm, if you think about it. You know, about a personal relationship with God. And rather shocking, don't you think, considering who this author's ancestor was, Korah. What about Psalm 44? Here's another one. It says in the introduction to the chief musician, a contemplation of the sons of Korah. Verse 1, we have heard with our ears, O God, our fathers have told us the deeds you did in their days, in days of old. You drove out the nations with your hand, but them you planted. You afflicted the peoples and cast them out. For they did not gain possession of the land by their own sword, nor did their own arm save them, but it was your right hand, your arm, and the light of your countenance, because you favored them. You are my king, O God. You know, we sing the psalm, O God, we have heard, and our fathers have taught the works which of old in their day thou hast wrought. Think about the sons of Korah. When they heard the stories, their father was a main actor, wasn't he? And yet, not in a positive way. He was sort of the bad boy of that generation. You know, not too many people maybe in that next generation named their son Korah. You know, it's sort of like naming them Adolf Hitler or something. By the way, if there's any young boy named Korah in the congregation or anyone, please excuse me, please, I'm sorry. It's a wonderful name, absolutely. But it does carry a little bit of connotation, doesn't it? And it certainly would have in those generations following this horrible episode. The point is, these men took a different path. Notice Psalm 45. Drop back into Psalm 44 just for a moment. It says, it finishes, for I will not trust in my bow, nor shall my sword save me, but you have saved us from our enemies and put to shame those who hated us. In God we boast all day long and praise your name forever. Wow. What a different attitude than their ancestor, Korah. Psalm 45, verse 1. Again, another one. To the chief musician, set to the lilies, a contemplation of the sons of Korah, a song of love. Verse 1, my heart is overflowing with a good theme. I recite my composition concerning the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword upon your thigh, O mighty one. With your glory and your majesty and in your majesty, ride prosperously because of truth, humility, and righteousness. And your right hand shall teach you awesome things. As it goes on, it clearly it's talking about the Messiah here. So they even wrote a psalm referring to, forward-looking, to the Messiah to come. Verse 6, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions. Imagine that. The sons of Korah had the honor of writing a psalm that was prophetic of the Messiah. It came from the sons of Korah. Psalm 46, notice. Psalm 46, again, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Verse 1, God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. You know, as we read these, we can even hear the songs in our mind, can't we? One of the most beautiful, one of the most powerful and moving psalms we have in the book. about God being our refuge. It says, even though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. You don't think that whoever wrote this had a little bit of feeling for what happens when the mountains move and the earth shakes? When they thought about their ancestor and Dathan and Abiram and the earth opening up and swallowing those people? And yet, he's writing, and these men are writing this psalm, talking about when those things happen, we know we can depend on our God. Totally different attitude than their ancestor. Verse 5, that God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn, the nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. A little bit prophetic of the millennial age of Christ's return. This is written by the sons of Korah. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Wow, what powerful words coming from the sons of Korah. Psalm 47, to the chief musician, a psalm of the sons of Korah, verse 1. Oh, clap your hands, all you people. Shout to God with the voice of triumph. For the Lord Most High is awesome. He is a great king over all the earth. Verse 5, God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Sing praises to God. Sing praises. Sing praises to our king. Sing praises, for God is the king of all the earth. Sing praises with understanding. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the people have gathered together, the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong to God. He is greatly exalted. Just think about it. These are the mind and the thoughts of the sons of Korah. You know, we often think about David and him pouring out his heart in the Psalms, and them being an expression of a very, very intimate expression of his relationship with God. Well, brethren, these are an intimate look into the thoughts of the sons of Korah as well, and their relationship with God. It's just remarkable. Psalm 48, verse 1, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God is his holy mountain, beautiful in elevation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. Another memorable hymn we sing, Mount Zion stands most beautiful. Isn't it interesting? Many of the songs that we sing today and are some of the most meaningful songs for us, psalms in the book, are from the sons of Korah. The mind and thoughts of the men descended from Korah. Verse 8, as we have heard, as we have seen in the city, the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, God will establish it forever. We have thought, O God, on your loving kindness in the midst of your temple, according to your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Let your right hand is full of righteousness. We're taking some time to go through these, but brethren, I think it's meaningful to think about and get a sense of how these men thought, whose ancestor was Korah. Maybe it'll even change how we think of these hymns the next time we sing them, and the next time we think of Korah. Psalm 49. Verse 1, hear this, O all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall give understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb, I will disclose my dark saying on the harp. Verse 12, nevertheless, man, though in honor, does not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish and of their posterity who approve their sayings. Like sheep they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them. The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall be consumed in the grave, far from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. What a powerful, powerful psalm. Notice, turn over a few pages to Psalm 84. Here's another one, Psalm 84. And this would be from page 54. O Lord of hosts, my King, my God. Might even be interesting if you have a personal hymnal just to even make a note somewhere on those psalms that we sing that are of the sons of Korah as we think about the different path that they took from their father. And what a powerful lesson that is for us. Psalm 84 and verse 1. How lovely is your tabernacle, O Lord of hosts. My soul longs, yes, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found a home, and the swallow a nest for herself where she may lay her young. Even your altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. Blessed are those who dwell in your house. They will still be praising you. He says, verse 8. O Lord God of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob. O God, behold our shield and look upon the face of your anointed. For a day in your courts is better than a thousand. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. Now stop and think about that for a moment. What was their role? Their family role was to be posted at the door, at the entrance of the tabernacle. Kind of interesting, isn't it? That was their job. And two, as we think about it, maybe we can overlook the importance of that role. It's almost like it's a diminished role when compared as it's mentioned here. But frankly, someone who is at the entrance of the tabernacle had a very important role. They were the greeter, like we have at the door, but they also were security, weren't they? This was not a small role for the sons of Korah to take care of. And yet they recognized, you know, to be a doorkeeper in the house of my God would be in so much better than to be in the tents of wickedness. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory, for no good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man who trusts in you. Psalm 85, notice in verse 8, it says, I will hear what God the Lord will speak, for he will speak peace to his people and his saints. But let them not turn back to folly. Surely his salvation is near to those who fear him, that glory may dwell in our land. Mercy and truth have met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed. Truth shall spring out of the earth, and righteousness shall look down from heaven. Psalm 87, it says in verse 1, his foundation is in the holy mountains. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are spoken of you, O city of God. And finally, Psalm 88, verse 1. O Lord God of my salvation, I've cried out day and night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry, for my soul is full of troubles. As it says in the introduction, a prayer for help in a time of despondency. So, we know the Psalms are very real, are very raw in terms of the emotions and the intensity of the relationship that these writers had with God. But it's not just David, and it's not just Asaph, and it's not just Moses, I think, has one of the Psalms, and Solomon has one of the Psalms. It's also the sons of Korah. So, with that very small introduction, What's the lesson? What's the lesson? Well, their father did a pretty bad thing. Wouldn't you say? But the sons of Korah did not just go along with it. Frankly, they had to stand against it, which would have been difficult. And they actually redefined what it meant to be a son of Korah. They created a new and different legacy. And you just sort of have to wonder why even as it, they're not mentioned by name in some of these Psalms here. And they have, what did we look at, 8 or 10 of the Psalms are written by the sons of Korah. And yet none of them have the actual name of the author. It's all the sons of Korah. Maybe there's a little bit of them wanting to redefine the legacy of Korah. Not by what he did, but by what his sons did. And it's what they did. They did redefine that. They took a very different path. It's a huge lesson. Because, you know, in this world, because this is Satan's world, sometimes in order to follow God, we have to go against family members. Christ said that would happen sometimes. And I think the sons of Korah can be a huge encouragement in that regard. You know, there are a couple of principles I think that apply here. One is the sins of the fathers do affect the next generation. If you just want it for your notes, Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 9, in discussing the second commandment, God says that yes, he will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. I don't know if it's always a specific curse that is given, or rather simply that there are physical consequences, that they're not immediately wiped out as a result of the mistakes that we make. You know, when we think of the millennium, when Christ returns, will he just immediately snap his fingers and suddenly families, individuals, people who have grown up a certain way will suddenly be different immediately, 180 degrees? Yes, they will be converted as they accept the sacrifice of Christ and they are repent of their sins. They're made That's made available to them, but then they'll need to start unlearning, won't they? And it might take a generation or two for them to teach the next generation, and then the next generation to really have a different path that is set. With God's Spirit, they will learn a different, a new way, but they'll be learning to get rid of old habits. There's another principle, Deuteronomy 24:16. It says, the father shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. So this is the other principle, that we all stand before God ourselves. And thank God for that. That we don't have to bear the penalty for the mistakes that someone else makes in the long term. We're not defined by them. You know, we are living in a world where increasingly all too many look for an excuse for what their life is like. Well, I was just brought up that way. It's because my father did this or my mother did that. We might be resentful of things that happen in our life, and we hold a grudge. And we make excuses for our behavior. You know, when you think about that, there are a lot of other examples in the Bible of people who had disobedient and even rebellious parents, but sons took a different path. You can look at some of the kings of Judah. Abijam, it says, walked in all the sins of his father. His heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David, but his son Asa was a righteous king. He chose a different path. Hezekiah was a righteous king. His father Ahaz was one who did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Josiah maybe is the greatest example. His grandfather was Manasseh and his father was Amon. Two evil, evil men, and Josiah was an amazing person. And frankly, let's turn over to Genesis chapter 3, because frankly, we all have parents who made mistakes, don't we? Their names are Adam and Eve. And raise your hand if Adam and Eve are not your parents. You don't have to raise your hand. It's a trick question. It's all of us. You know, none of us escape the horrible, horrible start that the human family had through Adam and Eve. It says in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, just dropping into the story, when the serpent was talking to the woman and was trying to get her to eat the fruit. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she said, "No, I'm not going to do it. God said, don't eat it. So I'm not going to disobey him." And it's been great for the human family ever since, right? Is that what it says in your Bible? No. Just the opposite. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they knew they were naked. They had sinned. They felt guilty. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves covering, and the rest is history. A horrible start. But brethren, are we going to let that cause us to say, "Oh well, I can't do anything about it"? Because of the start of all of us, our parents, Adam and Eve? I think, of course, the answer is no. You know, sometimes it's not big issues like rebellion and disobedience and evil like Korah or Manasseh, but maybe just good or bad habits. Maybe we think our parents are pretty good, have been pretty good. But as we get out of childhood, we begin to notice they're not perfect. Isn't that right? I think when we were all, those of you who are older, however that's defined, when you think back to when you were little, there's a point where you realize your parents are not perfect, and it's a little shocking at first. And if we're not careful, we can disrespect them for that, or we can justify our actions in what we allow or do. You know, it's a mature thing when we deeply respect our parents and yet we understand they make mistakes, and we're going to grow by watching them and learning from them, the positives and the negatives. Maybe that's why it's such an interesting experience as a parent, being a parent, because actually, you know, those of you who have been parents or are parents, you know the things that drive you up the wall the most? When your children do things that you do. And you can see those things coming out because you see yourself in them. It's like, you don't be like me in that area. It's okay in my better areas. Our kids are like a mirror. You know, if we have a problem with our temper, if they have a problem with their temper, we need to look at ourselves. What are we doing with controlling our emotions? If they are using bad language, we need to think, well, do I let some words slip out that shouldn't? Even if we don't have Korah-like parents, we're supposed to take what they gave us and improve on it. And our kids are supposed to improve on what we give them. No matter what legacy we have, brethren, that's our responsibility. And even further, there's something further, because God wants to give us a much greater legacy. And that is to bear his name. Isn't it amazing that you and I, no matter what legacy we have received from our parents and grandparents, good or bad, at varying degrees, do we fathom the opportunity we have to bear the name of our Father and receive His legacy? That's incredible. That's His plan. When we keep the holy days, when we go through the plan of salvation, and we're reminded that God is bringing many sons to glory, and right now He's working with the first fruits, and we're being given that opportunity to bear His name. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 20 and verse 7. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 7. This, of course, is one of the Ten Commandments. It says, Exodus 20 and verse 7, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." Of course, this means we shouldn't swear, use bad language, take his name frivolously, like is so common today with profanity and OMGs, you know, that slip out in social media from people who clearly are not walking as a Christian, and yet it's just a thing that people say, using God's name, which deserves so much respect in a very flippant way. We should be very careful about that. But you know, there's a deeper meaning to this as well. If we've committed to walking God's way, if we have been baptized, if we have received His Spirit, we are saying that we want to represent God, that we want to bear His name. And so once we are taking on His name, it needs to change us, doesn't it? It needs to transform us. We need to take it not in vain. Is it transforming us? Is it making a difference in our life? The fact that we are bearing God's name, that we are carrying a legacy from our Father that much surpasses any physical legacy that we could receive from our parents here. Remember what Korah said. We read it a little while ago. I'll read it to you again. He said, "You take too much on yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them." And Korah was absolutely right that the congregation is holy. Not that Moses was taking too much on himself, but he was absolutely right in the fact that God wanted the congregation to be holy, ultimately to bear His name and to walk in His name. He's talking about us, talking about our destiny of bearing the name of God and carrying the legacy of our Father in heaven. It's ironic that Korah's sons had to live down his legacy of claiming that holiness in a way to overthrow the government of God through Moses, when actually our opportunity to bear the name of God is going to be to uphold God's government forever. Notice in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 8, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 8, because we are preparing to live in God's family forever and bear His name. As it says here, Revelation 3 and verse 8, "I know your works. See, I have set up before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name." Notice in verse 10, "Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I'm coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one takes your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name." The opportunity to be functioning in God's government, the seat of God's government of the whole universe forever, as someone that is in this category of an attitude and spirit of letting Christ live in us. What an incredible destiny. Bearing God's name. What a legacy, brethren, that clay models, and that's what we are, have the opportunity to bear the name of God. And this is nothing new, but perhaps it's good to think about from time to time. Notice in John 17 and verse 6, John 17 and verse 6, just before he died, again, some of the things that were on his mind, he said in verse 6, I have manifested your name, he's praying to the Father, I have manifested your name to the men whom you have given me out of the world. They were yours. You gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Verse 11, now I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to you. Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. We are called by the name of God. His church is called the church of God. So collectively we are, but also individually we are bearing the name of God one by one, not just as a church. As we respond to him and as Christ lives his life in us. John 17, verse 25. O righteous Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you, and these have known that you sent me. And I have declared to them your name, and will declare it, that the love with which you love me may be in them and I in them. So one of the last concepts on Christ's mind as he was facing imminent death was helping his disciples to understand the enormity of bearing God's name and the incredible opportunity of taking on his name for ourselves and what it stands for. What a powerful thing that we can bear that name forever. Let's turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. You and I have been given an opportunity that from time to time it's good to stand back and meditate and stop and think about just what it is that God is calling us to do. Not just to come to church, not just to sit here and warm a seat, not to join a club, as important as it is to be together, as important as it is to fellowship and strengthen one another, brethren, we are bearing God's name. We are preparing to bear his name forever. He is in the process of giving us a legacy that is so priceless that we can't even fathom it. You know, we speak of the process of being born again. And that is not just a metaphor. That is not just an analogy. In our former association, as things fell apart, that's what they were saying. Well, it's just a good analogy. No, it's not. It's real. It's actual. God is reproducing himself in us. And how important that is. No matter where we came from, no matter what our background is, how important is that? You know, my dad used to, years ago, he liked learning about family history, and he would, for a while, he had learned that our family can be traced back, at least part of it, to Sir Francis Drake. And so in some messages, he had mentioned that he had found this out, and he felt pretty good about that, you know. Until someone came up to him one time and said, you know, Mr. McNair, Sir Francis Drake had a few unpalatable things in his life that maybe you don't want to do that. And my dad didn't really talk about it after that. You know, everyone has positives and negatives. But wow, the opportunity we have to bear the name of the King of the universe, and that legacy, and our elder brother, Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 1. For we know that if our earthly house this tent, our clay tent, our clay body, which is so weak and is so vulnerable, we know that if this tent is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, and sometimes that's what we do in this life, isn't it? When we're in pain or we're suffering and it's all we can do. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation which is from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has also given us the Spirit as a guarantee. You know what that means? It's a down payment. And nobody in their right mind puts a down payment on a possession unless they're committed to buying it, whether it's a car or a house. In other words, God says he's committed. He's given us a piece of himself, and it shows that he is committed to go all the way. He's given us the down payment as a guarantee. So we're always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Our destiny is to be called sons of God. And that's more valuable than anything we could ever have in this life. You know, the sons of Korah, brethren, were not limited by the past. What a powerful example they are of men and women, I would suspect, undoubtedly. Because you think about it, if those men were grown and they were married, they had to have strong and focused wives, didn't they? To get through that trial when Korah rebelled. You know, a wife can have a huge effect on a man. Either to help him see the big picture when he's struggling, or to feed his vanity and ego by telling him he's getting a raw deal. And boy, he can really, really do a number. She can. If she doesn't give him the right advice, I think about Mr. and Mrs. Bob League. Remember years ago when sometimes he would talk about how he and his wife made an agreement that neither one of them could be in a bad attitude at the same time? They had to switch off. You know, one of them had to be in the right attitude to keep the other centered. Now, it doesn't mean that she was publicly correcting him or a wife publicly, you know, correcting a husband. But I suspect that in those tents, you know, maybe after those grown sons, again, I'm conjecturing a little bit, but maybe if they were grown sons and they would be in the tent of their father complaining and griping and carping, and they'd go back to their own tent, they had some very serious conversations with their own wife. And I think they had strong and focused wives to help them sort through that mess. In whatever role we have right now, brethren, let's think beyond ourselves. If we have children, let's consider the legacy we are leaving them. You know, are we leaving them patterns of broken ways of relating? Are we leaving them patterns of dealing with conflict in unprofitable ways? Are we leaving them broken patterns of how we look at the church? Bad attitudes that we get into? You know, we all can get into a funk from time to time. But we as fathers, I speak to fathers now, we need to be real. If we spin out, if we get off track, if we get bitter, the likelihood is our families will follow. Leadership matters. God has given us a tremendous opportunity to lead our families. And maybe they won't follow a bad example, but the odds are they will. We are not just making decisions for ourselves. We can terribly influence those around us. But we can also leave them patterns of fathers and mothers who are God-fearing people. Not perfect, but who have the humility to admit when they're wrong and the humility to admit they haven't figured it all out. Notice in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And those children can build on what they've been given, and they can grow in their own lives, and they can build their own legacy. The point is, we do have influence on those around us, don't we? And not just our family. Hebrews 12 and verse 12, Paul writes, therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so what that which is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many be defiled. You know, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9:26, he said that, you know, he disciplined himself, lest after I preach to others, I myself should become disqualified. We have an influence on one another, and not just if we have children. Even if we don't have a family, we don't have children. You know, Mr. Ames right now is very sick. And Mr. and Mrs. Ames don't have children. But I don't think there would be any of us who would say they haven't had an impact on many of us. And not just in this room, but around the world. Both of them. You know, I think we've heard many times Mr. Ames say that he wanted his legacy to be, he turned many to righteousness, quoting Daniel 12, whatever it is, verses 2 or 3 or 4. He turned many to righteousness. I think he accomplished that. And I think his wife also accomplished that by being a strong support by his side at every step, don't you? You know, we leave a legacy whether or not we're married, whether or not we have children, because, brethren, we all are influencing one another, and we are preparing to rule with Christ. You know, there's a humorous poster. It says something to the effect, sort of darkly humorous, maybe your life is just a warning to others. And then it has a picture of a Titanic sinking. Very sad, very dark humor, but very sad too. Brethren, our life can be that way. Our life can be what not to do. Our legacy can be a challenge for those around us to resist the temptation to go along and follow our example. Or wouldn't it be better for us and for them if we were examples of what to do? Of what to do. Let's turn over to 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. And along the way, in our own little way, our own weak and feeble way, because we are weak and feeble. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but we are in this flesh, and this flesh is weak. And yet, we can help those around us take one step closer to becoming like God, like Christ, because that's the legacy we're striving for. 1 John 3 and verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. What a thought. What a picture. And what an incredible hope in that next instant of that next moment of life, after we take our last breath, the next moment that we're conscious of, we will see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. So, brethren, let's be encouraged and inspired by the legacy given to us by our Father and our elder brother, and strive to finish our race with all of our being, and let Christ live his life in us and carry the name of our Father. As fallible human beings that fall down and make mistakes and skin our knees and need to be cleaned up, but asking him to help us through his Spirit and guiding us and even gently correcting us. We have big shoes to fill, but it's God who is doing it through us and in us. You know, there's so much more to the story of Korah than meets the eye. And I think we can be encouraged about fulfilling the destiny God has laid out for us when we ponder, when we meditate on the surprising legacy of the sons of Korah.